Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Nature versus nurture is so last century. By now we know that it's not one or the other, it's both. And the questions are down to the level of individual genes and how our environments interact with our DNA to produce our individual and societal psychology. David Dobbs writes about the latest in behavioral genetics in the December issue of The Atlantic with a theory about what is called orchid children, and he joins me now to explain. David Dobbs, welcome to WNYC. Thanks so much
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Your article talks about dandelion children who seem to handle whatever life throws them versus orchid children who can either thrive with the right hothouse nurturing or wither, to keep the flower metaphor going, and develop mental illness or drug addiction if not raised carefully. Tell us more. How do you define dandelion children and orchid children?
Well, this is a metaphor, obviously, to describe a new way of looking at genetic, what we've called genetic vulnerability lately, which is a robust set of literature has tied certain gene variants, like a certain short version of a serotonin transporter gene, for instance. If you have the short version, you are statistically more likely to become depressed later in life or early in life. If you also go through very stressful times or have a very stressful or traumatic upbringing. So this new hypothesis leaps off of this genetic vulnerability hypothesis and argues that these risk variants, these risk genes, don't simply create a downside for people who have had unfortunate upbringings or experiences. They create heightened function in people who are more fortunate in their life course, who have not suffered repeated or intense periods of stress or trauma.
So can you give me an example of an orchid child or an orchid child profile?
Yes. This would be, for instance, there's a study that I talk about in the article that looks at kids in Leiden in the Netherlands who have a certain gene that some people call the ADHD gene. This is a gene that if you have it and your parenting is not as good as it might be, or other parts of it, your environment, are not as good as they might be, you're more likely to have so-called externalizing behaviors, like, which in toddlers means a whole lot of bad behavior, oppositional behavior, nose, temper tantrums, that sort of thing. And those kids, in turn, are more likely later on to have trouble in school, behavioral problems and learning problems, and even down the line in adulthood. So these are kids that if they have this one form of this one gene called the DRD4 gene, they, in a bad environment, they're statistically more likely to have these sorts of problems. But what this study is showing is that if you make changes in these kids' environment, in the way you sort of train their parents to recognize moments in their relationships with their kids where they can have a more productive interchange. These are toddlers and preschoolers. The parenting changes, and when the parenting changes, the kid starts to show far fewer of these bad behaviors. And their improvement, here's the key point, their improvement when they get the changing in the parenting style is a higher rate of improvement than you see in kids with the so-called normal or protective form of this same gene, who are generally considered more resilient, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the kids with the risk gene, if they get the intervention, they will actually improve more than the kids with the so-called protective gene who get the same intervention. So what you're seeing is, and this, there are several genes in which research has shown this, these genes which have been considered vulnerability genes because they make you more sensitive to bad environment, they also make you more sensitive to good environments.
So it's like the Longfellow poem about the little girl who, when she was good, she was very, very good, but when she was bad, she was hard.
Very much so, yes.
So what's the upside? I mean, take me further out, because if there are potentials for even even, I think you're saying that kids with what we identify as these vulnerabilities, like genetic predispositions to ADHD or depression, might also have certain genetic talents built into that if they can be tapped into. Has anybody followed this to adulthood and found that they have, you know, the potential for real leadership work or creative invention work or anything like that?
Well, there have been no longitudinal studies that track this in an active manner, looking what form the upside takes. Okay, but where this shows is in the many studies that have been done to identify what are the bad outcomes when you have these risk
right,
variants.
Right.
So, for instance, the risk variant of the serotonin transporter gene. This is a gene that has a major effect on brain chemistry, and it's been shown that if you have the short version, as it's called, of this particular gene, you are many times more likely to be depressed at some point in life if you've had, you know, a rough childhood or repeated or intense episodes of stress or trauma during the rest of your life. So it heightens your risk of depression in reaction to bad experiences. There have been many studies that have shown this effect. In those same studies, but largely unremarked upon by the researchers, mm-hmm. if you look at the people with the so-called risk allele, the risk variant, the short, who have not suffered those troubling string of life events, whose environment has been benign to good, they are actually less likely to be depressed at any point in their life than are the so-called protective gene people. And there is some suggestion in animal studies, for instance, in the work of Steve Sumi, a monkey researcher at the National Institutes of Health. His work is examined in this Atlantic article. What he has found by looking at these monkeys that have the short version, which if they have rough upbringing, they're fairly maladjusted monkeys. They're either very anxious and nervous and timid or hyper-aggressive mm-hmm. to an extreme. But the ones who have better parenting and they are in a sort of a safer, more friendly social environment, meaning their family has a lot of social support in the monkey troop. It's much like people here. There's, you know, an extensive network of social connections that mm-hmm. each monkey can take advantage of. Those luckier monkeys with the SS, they are demonstrably more successful in their troops. They have more friends. They have more allies, so that there is a conflict within the troop. They have more allies to work that out, either subtly or in more violent ways. And they are demonstrably functioning higher in the sense of they have attained a safer, more successful place in the little ecosystem of the troop and have more likelihood of passing on their genes and so on for that reason.
From a natural selection standpoint or a genetic psychology standpoint, you say that the orchid hypothesis may explain why susceptibility to depression and mental illness have not been weeded out by natural selection. Why might that be?
Well, this is one of the really powerful things about this hypothesis. It answers a question that the vulnerability hypothesis can't answer, which is if these genes confer only a downside, if the only thing, the only result of having this SS serotonin transporter gene, for instance, is that it makes you more vulnerable to a debilitating depression, and depression is a serious problem when it's bad, then why has this gene survived selection in the human population? And the fact is that about 20% of people worldwide have the short version of the serotonin transporter gene. That's a pretty large number for something that you would think would be weeded out. It gets more interesting when in the past 5 years or so, geneticists have been able to look back through time, in a sense, and see the prevalence of different genes at different times as humans developed. And the serotonin gene, the prevalence is 20% now. It was zero 80,000 years ago.
Huh.
So this is a gene that has appeared through a random mutation somewhere and then spread very rapidly.
So what's the theory? What evolutionary function might it be playing?
Well, there's a couple of possibilities here. One is that some of the traits that this gene and some of these other genes, this is not the only gene in question, some of these other orchid dandelion polymorphisms, some of the traits they produce in reaction to stress can be advantageous in certain situations. So, for instance, to be a bit extra anxious and sensitive to threat and to engage in what you might consider a strategic deference, this can be very valuable in some situations. Likewise, hyperaggression in some situations and even some niches within today's society can be advantageous at times of conflict and so on. It helps to have a certain percentage of the populace who will react fairly aggressively or assertively.
David.
And so that's one way. And the other way is, of course, the heightened function that some of these people get if their their life has been fortunate.
David Dobbs, my guest on WNYC, writing about the latest in behavioral genetics in the December issue of The Atlantic, with this theory of orchid children and dandelion children, that there may actually be some evolutionary reason that we have people who are genetically susceptible to things like depression and ADHD. Some people are calling in at 212-433-WNYC. So let's go to the phones. 212-433-9692. And Renee in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I love your show.
Thank you.
Love The Atlantic. It's great. I was wondering if that risk gene, I think you touched on it already, if what we see as maladaptive behavior in a basic social quantifying, way in Western society, it's like, you're hyperactive, but there's also this hypersexuality. And is it possible that these genes are proving to be productive in the modern context of the world because it increases fitness of offspring in a stressful environment? And can you see how this relates to social conditions in the world now? Like, it may seem like it's a social motivation for certain groups to have a lot of children, but in actuality it could be the biological impulse of this so-called risk gene.
That's a fascinating theory. And, David, I think multifaceted, because on one level, if some of the risk groups that were identified are prone to hypersexuality, even if the behaviors themselves are maladaptive in society, it may still result, in a natural selection and a lot more births to those kinds of people.
Well, yes, hypersexuality. I don't know of any gene variants tied to that, but it's an example of a trait that can be viewed, can be seen by culture and society as dysfunctional, but with hypersexuality in particular, you can see an upside from an evolutionary standpoint of passing on your genes. The more children you have, the more likely you'll, all other things being equal, you'll pass your genes on.
But as far as you know, there is no relationship between the kinds of genetic vulnerabilities you've been discussing and hypersexuality.
None that I know of. That's not to say that there's not a tie there somewhere, but there's none that I know of. I mean, she also mentioned, I believe she mentioned hyperactivity or ADHD, and this is a good example of a trait that can be seen as very dysfunctional in some environments, but quite adaptive in others. An air traffic controller with, well, maybe that's not the best example, but, I don't know if you want an accountant who is very distractible, but if you think of ADHD as a sort of attentional alertness, an alertness to new stimuli, you could see that perhaps this would be something very advantageous to have in a fighter pilot, where you don't want to be locked onto one thing. You want a lot of situational awareness. And just about any trait you can think of can be, until it gets extreme, has situations in which it's adaptive.
Which is why some proponents of technology, of, internet multitasking with 12 windows open on your screen as sort of becoming the current thing, argue that ADHD may be more adaptive than negative.
Certainly in some environments, and that's a sort of rich issue, is the culture that's developing now, does it actually stand more chance of rewarding this sort of attentional hypervigilance? So, well, as I put it in the story.
Right. And it would be just chance, because certainly the gene itself is much older than the technology that we're talking about.
Yeah, yes, it's a very young gene. It's only 40, 50, 60,000 years old, but it has gone from 0 to 33% prevalence in the human population. So as I put in the story, you can complain about it being an increasingly ADHD world these days, but it's been an increasingly ADHD world for about 50,000 years.
Right. Miriam in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hello, Miriam.
Oh, hi. I have a question that I don't know that there's a definitive answer to, but in the article, which I did recently read, you say that one of the behaviors that are treated and, often and are identified with this are things that bother elementary school teachers, and I thought that was right on. There's such a high percentage of young children now who are being medicated, you know, diagnosed with ADHD and other behavioral disorders because they can't sit still in the classroom. If the case is that they really have a greater potential because of this gene, but it's being medicated, what's the likelihood that the potential is being diminished?
By being medicated?
Yes.
Well, I think there's obviously potential there. I mean, that's a huge controversial area. I'm of the thinking that we're a little quick to pathologize a lot of behaviors and a little quick to medicate them, especially in children. There was one, and I think this is a real danger, that something that I don't know how many people I've talked to since I've written this story who have brought up, you know, cases close to their own lives in which they've seen this. A six-year-old who the teacher complains, there seems to be a problem here. He fidgets. Well, he's six. He fidgets. And one woman wrote in on a website that commented on, it was an educational website that commented on the story, and she wrote about her oldest child, who's now 14, and she says an extraordinarily mature 14-year-old, but she said that he was, she was told again and again and again in the first 6 years, she was constantly fending off the suggestion that there was something wrong with him. And she finally learned to say, stubborn is just the other side of determined, and overly emotional is just an undisciplined way of being passionate. And the boy is 14 now, and he's 14. He's still got some bursts on him. But he functions very well, and she doesn't hear anymore that there's something wrong with him. So there's a sort of heightened malleability and reactivity to environment in these people is the idea, in these orchid gene kids, that can create strong behaviors. And the strong behaviors can be pathologized, or they can be seen as part of a broad, part of a variability and a mercurial nature that can be more easily molded into something positive if you work with it.
We're going to run out of time soon, but a clinical psychologist in Harlem is calling in, I think, to say that people who have the capacity to be more stressed also could become more resilient. Michael in Harlem, want to explain that?
Yes, hi. I do a kind of technique called affect regulation therapy. In other words, helping people regulate their feelings, be more resilient. People who got this gene, it sounds like, are people who react to smaller stresses with a higher degree of emotion, and that in this case, in an optimal environment, they learn to be more resilient than the average person because they have more opportunities in a resilient environment to adapt. And therefore, they plus, if someone's depressed, they actually see things more clearly than the average person. So I can see how that can lead to a leadership position in a well-regulated community.
Indeed.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
I think that's very much along the idea here, is that this creates a heightened responsiveness in general in a certain domain. And the domain's different. Some people will be more sensitive to social interaction. Some people will be more sensitive to other parts of the environment. But whatever it is, the heightened responsiveness is sort of a clue to what avenue can most productively reach that person, and to an arena in which perhaps they can particularly excel or improve their performance if it's cultivated. And one part of the power of this this hypothesis is it not only brings in a lot of data, the scientific data and findings that has been kind of orphaned before, but in terms of the behavior of any given person, it can start to make sense of behaviors that otherwise are inexplicable. So that when my five-year-old has a complete meltdown because her socks won't fit a certain way over her tights, I can see this as another facet of the same wonderful responsiveness she has to pleasant things that go well with her clothes or otherwise.
And the accuracy comment by the caller is interesting, too. I think we'll have to leave this for another segment someday, but I know there have been studies that seem to indicate that human beings in general have an optimism bias and tend to exaggerate the likelihood of successful outcomes of things. And those people who are depressed or pessimistic actually statistically have a more clear-eyed view of what the future is likely to hold, depressing as that idea is to contemplate. But we will leave it there with David Dobbs, who writes about the latest in behavioral genetics in the December issue of The Atlantic, with a theory about orchid children, so-called, and dandelion children. Thanks very much for coming on. This has been fascinating.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Terrence Samuel is up next with his latest thoughts. Stay with us.